In this week's show, we're exploring the impact of the passage of time on our games and on the people who play them and on the people who watch them. Lots of the most accomplished athletes begin understanding themselves as dedicated athletes when they're still children. So it was fun to speak this week with Amy Chow, who was a member of the so-called Magnificent Seven team of gymnasts who won gold at the Atlanta Olympics in 1996. She knew from the time she was a small child that she wanted to be a doctor.
Apparently, my mom told me when I was, eight or something, I had finished going to the doctor, and I told her that I wanted to be a pediatrician when I grew up. So it always had been in the back of my mind, even while I was training.
Dr. Chow, now a pediatrician in California, was referring to her training as a gymnast. She also trained as a pianist and as a diver, and somewhere along the line, she became a pretty good pole vaulter, all the while excelling in school, which her parents made a priority even over gymnastics. That's a strategy with which former Ohio State football star Maurice Claret has come to agree, belatedly.
Ain't nothing wrong with getting an education. If you made it from your neighborhood and you made it on campus and all you did was basically play to the end of Florida State and you got a real education, not no bull classes, that's cool.
That was part of the message recorded by ESPN that Claret delivered recently to the members of the football team at Florida State. It was a lesson he'd learned after failing to take advantage of the educational opportunities he might have had and sabotaging his football career by fighting with his coaches, among other missteps. Eventually, he went to prison for armed robbery. Now he's advising young male athletes to do as he says rather than as he did. Tim McCormick, who played in the NBA for 10 years, now runs the Rookie Transition Program sponsored by the NBA Players Association. The idea of the Rookie Program and programs for players leaving the NBA is to help them explore careers within and beyond the game. They have the opportunity to learn about not only coaching, but real estate investment and franchising. The programs are designed to help players understand that time will pass, probably more quickly than they anticipate, and that they will have lots of time when their careers in the NBA end to do something else.
That's the reality. Michael Jordan, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Bill Russell, everybody gets another job because people are so competitive. You don't want to live a life of playing golf and laying by the pool for the next 40 or 50 years. I think, you know, it sounds good for an off season, but it's not a real good reality for our players to think that that's the way the future is going to be.
Most ex-NBA players don't have the specific talents evident in the post-basketball work of those three gentlemen. Jordan is a marketing giant, while Russell and Abdul-Jabbar have risen above their basketball achievements as spokespeople for causes much larger than the game. But lots of ex-NBA players are lifetime athletes, trying to figure out what comes next. A few years ago, Antoine Walker was among them. A three-time All-Star, Walker played for 12 seasons. During that time and shortly thereafter, he took on the responsibility for supporting about 70 family members and friends, made bad investments, began gambling in a big way, and lost $110 million. Eventually, he pleaded guilty to charges that he'd written bad checks. Walker went through the NBA's rookie program, and he doesn't feel it covers the necessary ground as far as handling money is concerned.
I think you have to bring Antoine Walker and other guys of my type out and let these guys have real stories. I think you can put a financial firm in front of them, and that's great. But you need to let these guys hear real stories, real life situations. Then it hits home. I think if they're not able to do that and they shy away from that, then it will never make a difference.
These days, Antoine Walker speaks to athletes and entertainers on behalf of the Global Sports and Entertainment Financial Education Program, established by Morgan Stanley. His message isn't complicated.
You get a lot of money at an early age, and you don't understand and know what to do with it. And we don't think for the future. I think that's the biggest thing. We don't think for being 35, 40 years old, because we're 18, 19, 20 years old, and we think we're going to make money forever.
Walker found the league wasn't interested in counseling him on the way out.
Kind of thrown to the wolves, and I understand that. I get that wholeheartedly. We know we all make mistakes, but they pretty much, you know, you're on your own after that.
Tim McCormick of the NBA Players Association feels the only players who have to feel they're entirely on their own when their careers end, and most of them end after only a few seasons, are the players who choose not to take advantage of the programs McCormick is offering. He suggests that time has increased the options open to players leaving the NBA. That makes sense. It seems to have changed everything else about our games. Jeremy Bloom competed in two Olympics as a freestyle skier. He was drafted by the NFL's Philadelphia Eagles in 2006, though his pro football career was derailed by injuries. In 2008, he established Wish of a Lifetime, a foundation that grants wishes to the elderly, and he's the CEO of Integrate, a company he co-founded that helps clients coordinate advertising strategies. Jeremy Bloom, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
You've acknowledged that when you were 19, a world champion skier, freshman All-American football player at the University of Colorado, you were scared to death. That's a quote about what would happen after athletics. What was the source of the fear?
The source of the fear, it was wrapped up in the identity that you establish as a professional athlete. You pretty much live your entire life, whatever the sport may be, as that sport defining you. And in my life, that was very true in two sports. I was Jeremy Bloom, the football player, Jeremy Bloom, the skier. And it's a pretty amazing lifestyle. You know, you're traveling the world and getting paid to ski in the Swiss Alps. It's a little little crazy, you know? I mean, people like you and people want to do things for you. And throughout my athletic career, I watched friends retire and just really lose this identity. And a lot of them would become depressed, and some of them would make bad investment decisions and lose money. And so at 19, I couldn't help but think to myself, well, what is my life going to look like after football and skiing? And what are things I could do now at 19 that could translate into this new world that at some point I'm going to experience?
Do you think other pro athletes share the fear of what happens when they're finished playing, or do most of them deny that that day will ever come?
Well, it's a bit of a mix, but I certainly know that there are a lot of players that think about that. I partnered with the NFL this past year in the Wharton Business School in San Francisco to bring out 40 players in the NFL and expose them to Silicon Valley so they could start thinking about, you know, what they wanted to do next in their career. And the NFL has this incredible program for NFL players. You can take business classes at Stanford, Kellogg, Harvard, or Wharton. And just spending time with those 40 guys, they're all thinking about what's next. And there were some rookies that came out. There were some second-year players that came out for that program. And I think part of the reason they did, obviously the interest in Silicon Valley and startups and tech, but I think a big driver for them to come out to it was fear. Fear of what they're going to do after athletics. And I think there's unhealthy sources of fear and there's healthy sources of fear, and I think that's a healthy source of fear.
Only a Game did a story about 10 years ago about the program at Harvard Business School for NFL players, and one of the messages some players got there was to understand that nothing they do in their post-playing career would give them the thrills that playing in the NFL had provided. Is that good advice?
I think it's fair advice. I heard that as well, and I never truly believed it. And I started a company, and it just started growing really quickly. And before I knew it, we're almost 5 years old, and we've raised $40 million of venture capital. So, you know, there's a lot of pressure in my life to perform. That's real stakes that you're playing in, and you have over 100 employees, and you're focused on building a great culture and a good team. And, you know, is it the butterflies that I got when I was returning a punt against 11 crazy guys that were much larger than I was and wanted to take my head off? Maybe not, but you still deal with the pressures of competition. So, I think you can get that stimulation. It's just in a different form.
Do you ever look back and think, gee, I was good enough to play 10 or 12 years in the NFL? Are you disappointed you didn't have that kind of career?
No, I look back and say, gosh, what a perfect NFL career for me, because I got exposure to two incredible organizations, the Pittsburgh Steelers and the Philadelphia Eagles, and I got to share the locker room with Ben Roethlisberger and Hines Ward and Donovan McNabb, all these players I really looked up to, and I got to experience that without too much injury. So no, I look back and I'm quite happy with the career I had.
You studied at the Wharton Business School when you were an NFL rookie. The NFL and the Players Union also partners with the Harvard Business School, Northwestern's Kellogg School, Stanford Graduate School of Business, and others. What are the most important things those programs should provide?
Really easy. Provide the first step. And just like in anything in life, when you set a goal, you set this really big goal. And for a professional athlete, moving on or what's next, that's a really big, unknown, kind of scary goal. And what those programs do such a good job to provide is that first step in that direction. And those programs are great connectors, not only to the things that matter, but the people that matter.
Jeremy Bloom is a former football player and Olympic skier. He's currently an entrepreneur, a philanthropist, and a TV analyst for college football and the Olympics. Jeremy, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure.
Athletes and their circumstances change over time, and the most adaptable of those athletes thrive. The same is true of team owners. I've been looking at photographs from the early days of the World Series, 1903, 1905, and 1906. They feature fans sitting and standing on the field. Some of them occupy the edges of the outfield. Some sit where a catcher or first baseman might have caught a pop-up if those fans hadn't been in the way. The fans are separated from the players by ropes. Lots of them are dressed in suits, and many are wearing derbies. They appear respectable. Maybe that's why the club owners felt mere ropes would discourage them from grabbing the outfielders by the belt or stealing their hats. Increasing the capacity at those World Series games increased the take for the owners, never mind that the policy turned foul pops into second chances for the hitters and made ground rule doubles of fly balls that fell among the gents who'd been leaning over the center fielder's shoulder. No contemporary owner would dream of trying to increase profits by setting up a row of folding chairs in front of the third base dugout. Now they cash in by building luxury boxes in parks they've financed by threatening to move their teams. The luxury box money, the concessions the owners get from various mayors and governors, and the broadcast revenues add up. That's part of the reason today's teams annually increase in value no matter how badly they play. In the days when fans stood behind ropes, Major League Baseball teams sometimes went under. Whither the Cleveland Spiders of yesteryear? So sure, it was good to be an owner back in the day when the reserve clause prevented players from testing the market, but perhaps it's even better to be one today, when Major League Baseball can take advantage of in-stadium arcades, restaurants, and malls, video games, fantasy teams, replica jerseys, and lots of other revenue streams those fellows peddling standing room in the outfield couldn't even have imagined. Tom Watson won 39 times on the PGA Tour, including 8 majors. He's a 6-time PGA Player of the Year, and he's won 13 times playing on the Over 50 Champions Tour. He was elected to the PGA World Golf Hall of Fame in 1988. I could go on, but if I mentioned all of Tom Watson's accomplishments on and off the golf course, I'd have no time to talk with him, so we'll get right to it. Tom Watson, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Tom, you just played your last British Open, which you have won 5 times. You've announced that the 2016 Masters will be your last at Augusta National. I'm not sure if you have plans to actually retire, but it's clear that you've chosen to wind down your career. Tell us a little bit about that decision.
Well, the decision is pretty easy about Augusta. It's a golf course that's just too long for me anymore. I've struggled the last 8 or 10 years with the added length of the course. The kids hit the ball a lot farther than the old guys do, and it just makes it very, very difficult to compete on a course like that. So it's time. It's time for me to leave another spot for somebody who's more capable than I am to compete there.
Back in July, you said the toolbox is kind of half empty with the tools I used to be able to play good golf. Those tools are missing right now, or they're pretty rusty, like me. When did you begin to come to that conclusion?
Well, in the last couple of years, my distance has left me. You have to be able to carry the ball 270 to 280 in the air, and I can't do that anymore. Up until about 2 years ago, I could carry it 260 in the air, and now it's just 250, so that distance tool has left me.
You first learned golf when you were just 6 years old, so you've been playing the game for over 6 decades. You've witnessed a lot of change over that time. Talk a little bit about some of the differences between the game of golf 20, 30, 40, even 50 years ago and the game as it stands now.
Well, let me preface that by saying that the game significantly hasn't changed. You use tools to hit a 1.68 inch golf ball into a 4.25 inch hole. And it really hasn't changed. Now, if you put it in another context, the equipment with which we play now compared to the hickory shafted clubs with all the torque and the different swing you had to put on that, then the invention of the steel shaft, which made it a lot easier to hit the ball straighter, to the invention of the golf balls that go farther and straighter and higher, the game has changed somewhat in that respect. And they've adequately lengthened the golf courses to try to keep the scores pretty much in comparison to the scores of yesteryear. But it seems after this last week at the PGA, when Jason Day shot 20 under par to win the PGA, a very difficult whistling straights course, that maybe there is something, too, that the game has changed significantly with the invention of this new equipment.
You know, as I was getting ready for this conversation, I thought perhaps I would ask you for your most memorable moment from your decades of competition. But I'm going to take a wild guess, and I'm going to say that it might have been this.
Looks
gently
good.
Done.
Looks good. Do you believe it? Do you believe
what
it?
What can you say? Tom Watson pitching into the hole for a birdie has taken the lead in the U.S. Open. One more par.
This, of course, is your chip from the Pebble Beach rough to birdie the 71st hole of the 1982 U.S. Open. Describe what that moment was like for you when you edged Jack Nicklaus to win that tournament for the first time.
Well, the U.S. Open was the tournament I always wanted to win the most. I had won the British Open, I won the Masters, and I hadn't won the PGA or the U.S. Open. But the U.S. Open was the prime tournament that I wanted to win. My dad always was a U.S. Open aficionado. He knew the names of all the great champions from year one in 1895 on, and I grew up with that. To win it was the most important thing in my life, is to win in my career, is to win the U.S. Open. And when I chipped that lucky chip in, and it propelled me on to win, it was maybe the most special moment in my career.
Do you have other favorite memories of particular tournaments or rounds or rivals?
I do. Actually, my favorite memory, and I've blogged about it, is when I was 14 years old, I loved the game, and I played some golf here in Kansas City against the men when I was 13. And then at age 14, I entered into and played in the Kansas City Men's Match Play Championship. And I got into the finals against a man by the name of Bob Devine. He had me 3 down after 19 holes, and I ended up winning 4 and 3. And at age 14, beating the men, it either gave me a big head or it gave me the dream that maybe someday I could be the golfer I wanted to be and compete against the likes of Arnold Palmer, my hero, and beat the villain Jack Nicklaus at the time.
Well, what about today's golfers? As you look sort of at the tournaments today, are there particular young golfers you think are especially good for the game?
Well, right now, I think the professional game is in the best shape it's been in years. When you look at Rory McIlroy and what he's done over the last 3 years, and then what Jordan Spieth did this year was the best from a scoring standpoint in the history of the game. And then you include Jason Day, who was the best golfer never to win a major championship until this last week at the PGA.
Mm-hmm.
You have three golfers right there that they have the platform to carry this game on and for the next decade and for a long, long time.
In addition to your golf career, you have been quite active as a businessman and as a philanthropist. When your competitive career does end, will you focus on those things, or are there other projects with which you're going to become involved?
Well, I've always enjoyed trying to teach the game. Through our first tee program here in Kansas City, we reached out to over 2,500 kids in summer programs and yet another 5,000 to 6,000 kids in the winter programs in schools, trying to promote the game, to try to get the kids interested in playing the game. We have a real problem with that. The time spent on social media and the cell phones has taken away the time that kids used to be able to spend on sports, in particular golf. Golf takes quite a long time to play. We have to really address this seriously and try to get kids out to play and have fun playing. And that probably means shorter sessions to get them out on the golf course to play 1 or 2 or 3 holes. PGA, the teachers, the golf professionals, they have to carry the ball and get to the kids and through their parents to get on the golf course, to get out there and enjoy the game, learn the game, so that we have golfers for the future.
I'm told that you have a degree in psychology from Stanford. I thought maybe you would be out there offering psychoanalytic services to golfers who had the yips.
I need one for myself.
Tom Watson, champion golfer, philanthropist, businessman, thank you very much for speaking with me, and I wish you good luck.
Bill, thank you. I enjoyed the conversation.
When J.R. Richard was scheduled to pitch, batters sometimes came up with suddenly sore arms, headaches, or flu-like symptoms. At the peak of his career in the late 70s, when the 6'8 right-hander was striking out more than 300 batters a season, with a fastball that exceeded 100 miles an hour, the Houston Astros pitcher was among the most intimidating figures in baseball. That chapter in his life ended suddenly in the summer of 1980 when Richard was felled by a stroke. In a recent book titled Still Throwing Heat, Richard reviews his career and discusses the life he has built beyond the success he enjoyed and the difficulties he has endured. J.R. Richard, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
In your first start with Houston in 1971, you beat the Giants, and in doing so, I understand you made quite an impression on the man I consider the greatest player ever, Willie Mays. Tell us about that.
Well, matter of fact, when I was totally surprised that I got a chance to pitch that day because I had just come up at the end of the year with the Astros, and I didn't really think about Willie Mays, Willie McCovey, or Bobby Bonds, or any of those guys, superstars, being in the lineup. My thing was just to become the best that I could be and do the best job that I could do. And he told the first baseman the reason I didn't strike him out four times because he took himself out of the game.
But you did strike him out three times.
He'd rather struck out three times than be dead once.
In 1980, mid-season, you collapsed during a workout. Please tell me about what happened.
Well, as far as back as I can remember, I felt a lot of high-pitched tone ringing in my left ear, which I didn't think nothing about it at that time. I kind of just shook it off and kept on throwing a few more. Then I threw a couple of more, then I become real nauseated, and I laid down on the Astrodome floor. And the next thing I remember, I was waking up in the hospital. I had been complaining to the Astros for almost a month or two about something was wrong. And if I'm such a valuable asset to the ball club, why wasn't I immediately rushed to the doctors from Chicago when it first started? Mm-hmm. Again, if I was such a valuable asset to the company.
During an interview in 1984, 4 years after your major league career ended, you said, "I call what happened to me the big trade. I traded baseball for the life of God." But 10 years later, after losing $1 million and a home in a business scam and two divorce settlements, you were homeless and sleeping under a bridge. What happened?
That was the only way he could really get my attention, is to get me away from everybody and everything so he can sit down and talk to me one-on-one. God did not make me to become homeless. He cared more about me than being homeless, and I know I was better than that.
I'm curious about the time that you were homeless. You're 6'8" tall. You were a star in Houston, no doubt about that, a very recognizable figure. Did people who were in that homeless community of sorts know who you were?
Some did, some didn't. People see you. First of all, they can't believe it. And they don't really want to bother you. They probably look at you and say, okay, he don't look like he's the happy camper. So I looked like I wasn't a man to be messed with at that time.
Your homelessness stretched from late 1994 into 1995, but you got some help from Houston's Now Testament Church. You found a job with an asphalt company and then returned to the church as a minister. But you say in the book that even with the outside help, you helped yourself. How so?
Well, I changed my thinking, which changed my attitude. I'm not going to do the same old things and act the same old way because God is right here. So, and I just simply changed my thinking and didn't accept the negativity.
Did any of your ex-teammates or maybe some of the guys against whom you played in the big leagues help you out at that point?
No, they did not. Not a one. Not even ball club at that time.
When you look back at your baseball career now, and I know you must have in order to go through what you went through to write this book, are you bitter?
Not at all. Never have been bitter. It's always been the other way around. See, when people don't understand who you are, when people can't control you, they have a tendency to want to destroy you. But see, you got to realize this. Sports is a business. Nothing more or nothing less.
You occasionally speak at various churches and at baseball camps, and now you're promoting a book. How have those activities kept you busy?
Well, I'm sitting here talking to you right now in these days, and everything is real well, and I'm staying close to the ministry right now because my main concern right now is God.
You also have helped Houston's homeless through your ministry, right?
Yes, I have. What I'm trying to do is change their mind. They got to have a different mindset. See, a man could eat a whole whale, but it takes one bite at a time. Or he can walk a mile, but it takes one step at a time. So if you're willing to take that step He will make a way out of no way. See, God is the only one I know can take a mess, go in a mess, clean up a mess, and come back out and don't be messy. Now you figure that out.
With the assistance of Lou Friedman, J.R. Richard has written Still Throwing Heat, and he joined me from KUHF in Houston. J.R., thank you very much for speaking with me, and I wish you the best going forward.
Thank you, sir. It's been my pleasure.
Recent years have seen increases in women's participation in sports, most of which are, well, women's sports. But last year, WNBA star Becky Hammon was hired as an assistant coach by the San Antonio Spurs, and just last month, Jan Welter, a veteran of women's pro football, was hired by the Arizona Cardinals as a coaching intern for training camp. As KJZZ's Phil Latzman found out, Jen Welter, who has a Ph.D. in psychology, has made a big impression on the players.
I could not have dreamed big enough to imagine that this day would ever come.
The Cardinals got the sports world's attention at a press conference last month when they introduced Welter as part of their staff with head coach Bruce Arians by her side.
Though it's a dream I never could have had, now it's a dream other girls can grow up and have. And so I guess if that makes me a trailblazer, then...
She's a trailblazer.
I'm on it, you know.
The 37-year-old Welter, who has a doctorate in psychology, has been playing football for 15 years, first as a linebacker for the Dallas Diamonds of the Women's Football Alliance. Then in 2014, she became the first woman to play a non-kicking position with the men when she took the field as a running back for the Texas Revolution of the Champions Indoor Football League. With the Cardinals, she's helping coach the team's inside linebackers. The team has not made her available for individual interviews, but after 2 weeks, Arians was impressed.
She's been fantastic, 100 times more than I thought it would be. And players have embraced her as a coach. They listen. She's got really good insight. As they call her Dr. J, there's a really good rapport out there right now.
In the locker room, players agree. Cornerback Patrick Peterson is one of the team's leaders on defense.
She fits right in. You don't even know that she's a woman when she's in there giving guys technical input. You can't even tell that she's a lady.
But to find out how Welter is really doing, you need to make your way over to the linebackers, the burly guys in the center of the defense who dish out hits and make the majority of the tackles. Second-year pro Kenny Demons says she's helped him with technique.
She's real big on footwork and eyes. You know, if you get your eyes in the right place, it's going to take you to the ball. It's going to take you to wherever you have to be.
Another young player, Kevin Minter, says Welter has helped him get back to the basics.
She's a stickler for fundamentals. You kind of get away from that a bit, you know, being at this level sometimes. With her, you know, she's always on footwork, staying behind the ball, you know, that sort of thing. And it's having someone reinforce that is kind of, you know, kind of refreshing. Like, okay, yeah, let me get back to my linebacker one-on-one.
And it didn't take long for Alex Okafor to figure out his new coach was no joke.
She knows the game, and I think that was just the biggest skepticism with her coming in, is does she actually know the game? And she does.
And when did you know that she knew the game and that she meant business?
When she was kind of, you know, coaching me up on some technical issues about hand placement and, you know, driving my feet and stuff like that and flipping my hips, I was like, okay, you actually know what you're talking about, you know? Let's go. Let's get this thing going.
And even the veterans like Lamar Woodley, who signed with the Cardinals in the offseason after his stint in Pittsburgh, say Welter is the real deal, even if she never played in the NFL.
I think it doesn't matter at all because, from the simple fact, you have a lot of coaches that's coaching the NFL that never played a down of football then in life and they're coaching. So I don't think it's any different than any woman who have played a down of football and also get the knowledge of football and come out here and coach.
Cardinals head coach Bruce Arians says his bold move is already paying off.
We're just happy to give her this opportunity, and she's run with it. I mean, she's really done a great job.
As for Welter, she appreciates the opportunity and the support of Arians.
He had to get all of the right yeses, but it was his heart that made it happen, and it was his belief that the Arizona Cardinals was the team that could handle this happening, and that he had coaches on his staff that would embrace it, not cast me off to the side.
But Welter may not be a permanent fixture with the Cardinals. As a coaching intern, she's only guaranteed 6 weeks on the staff. A decision will be made on her long-term role with the team when the preseason ends in September. For Only a Game, I'm Phil Latzman in Phoenix.
As time passes, athletes age along with the games they play, and so do fans. and for the supporters of one sport. And that sport, in quotation marks, getting older often means losing interest. But as Only a Game's Martin Kessler reports, that's changing.
David Shoemaker has been writing about professional wrestling since 2010, at which point his stories weren't reaching a broad audience.
It was like a real oddity. It used to be people would like sidle up to me and in like hushed tones tell me that they watched wrestling when they were kids. And now it's like, honestly, I think I get a more positive reaction than like the esteemed NBA writer standing next to me.
Professional wrestling, you know, shirtless guys pretending to beat each other up, is re-entering the mainstream for the first time since the late 90s. Media outlets like Shoemaker's Grantland, Rolling Stone, and SB Nation now have writers and columns devoted to world wrestling entertainment. And the WWE, the biggest wrestling company, has seen its revenue grow every year since 2010. I'd never paid attention to wrestling, but starting a few months ago, I noticed more and more people talking on Twitter and Facebook about body slams and drop kicks, and that left me wondering, what happened?
Bring it.
To begin to answer that question, let's go back to 1998. On your mark, ready, set, let's go. Will Smith was making music. Sports fans were fascinated by a home run race.
Faxel winds and fires. Big Mac, swing and a shot into the corner. It might make it. There it is. 62, folks. It just got over the left.
But for one group of fans, baseball took a back seat on Monday nights.
Sammy Sosa and Mark McGwire were going against each other, just slapping balls out of parks. Guess what, though? On Monday nights, you ain't watching those games. You are watching wrestling.
24-year-old Jose Zapata was just 7 in 1998. Pro wrestling had been on TV for decades, but in the late 90s, it entered into a golden age. Two companies aired competing programs every Monday night that drew huge audiences. The spectacle was massively popular among kids, at least when their parents weren't meddling. For Zapata and his friend Parker Crane, wrestlers like Stone Cold Steve Austin and The Rock were superstars.
It's really hard to overstate how cool The Rock was if you were 8 years old in 1999. Like,
oh,
there was probably not a cooler. He said the dumbest stuff. Like, his catch lines are like, can you smell what The Rock is cooking?
If you smell what The Rock is cooking.
And he called people jabronis all the time. Out of context, not cool at all, but he pulled it off.
Then sometime around the start of fifth grade, Zapata and Crane, and their peers at middle schools across the country, faced criticism of their passion as hard and unbreakable as, well, The Rock.
You know it's fake, don't you?
Again, wrestling writer David Shoemaker.
What makes wrestling difficult at a certain point in your life is the embarrassment of it.
The criticism was eventually too much to handle for Zapata and Crane.
I don't know, you're getting into like your manhood. You don't want to think about like fake things. That's when I hated it. I was like, oh, guys, come on. You can't watch this anymore.
There was like a social stigma. I was like, oh, glad I'm not watching that anymore.
Did they even miss it?
I really didn't think about it.
Yeah, I didn't think about it really either. I think it just kind of like fell out of my mind.
It's all about. That's why Daniel Bryan said earlier tonight he stands here unbroken. That these people are behind him. That he's stronger than ever. It's the never give up attitude of Daniel Bryan.
In very general terms, I'm much smaller. I don't use curse words.
Daniel Bryan, author of the new autobiography Yes, is one of the most popular wrestlers out there today. But at just 5'10" and with a shaggy beard, he looks more like a guy you'd run into at Whole Foods than one of those bulging wrestling stars from the late 90s. He's got fans of all ages, but one group stands out: young adults who used to root for the rough and tumble stars of the 90s.
I get a lot of people who tell me that I got them back into wrestling. And I'll ask them sometimes, I'll be like, well, how did that happen? And they say they don't really know. They just connected with the story.
While there have always been some storylines, you know, the good guy versus the heel, recently they've become more elaborate. On camera, Bryan is portrayed as the ultimate underdog, a small but talented wrestler who's even left out of some big events while he tries to earn the respect of management. The story's been a hit.
WWE is theater with this heavy dose of actual athleticism.
That's Marissa Payne, a sports writer for the Washington Post and a wrestling fan.
I really like live theater, and I look at this and you have these characters in both, and you have sort of the stage in both, and it happens live in front of you.
Pain represents a new wave of wrestling fan, young adults who have latched on to these recent plot lines. It seems to be paying dividends. In 2014, WWE's revenue reached $542 million. The drama is what pushed Zapata and Crane to reconnect with their old pastime. One night last year, they turned on a match, expecting it to be boring. But then they were caught off guard by a plot twist. A wrestler invoked an obscure rule to win. What impressed Crane and Zapata was that the twist had been foreshadowed earlier in the event, a writing technique far too subtle for the creators of the shows from the late 90s.
Those sorts of moments are possible where people are aware of the unreality and think they're like above it, but then they get socked by it as well.
And it sucks you right back in.
It helps that now they can connect with other adult fans who have also been sucked right back in. They all use social media to discuss the latest match or to point out an especially ludicrous moment. And that, Grantland's David Shoemaker thinks, is key.
To publicly state that you see it as the farce that it is, like, it's an affirmation for a lot of wrestling fans. The ancient antecedent for professional wrestling is not Greco-Roman wrestling. It's Greek theater, you know, with gigantic wooden masks so that you can see the frown from 50 rows back. That's what pro wrestling is.
And thanks in part to returning fans like Crane and Zapata, this modern form of Greek theater is currently a hit. Next year's main event, WrestleMania 32 at the home of the Dallas Cowboys, isn't until April. But there's already speculation it could be the first to draw more than 100,000 fans. For Only a Game, I'm Martin Kessler.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, some sports fans grow out of the enthusiasm they felt when they were children, and some fall back into it. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Changes over time in games and the people who play them. That has been our theme this week. How do you feel about some of the changes, good and bad, that you have witnessed for your decades as a sports writer?
I'm going to ignore the obvious insult implied in the word decades, only because it's true.
Same decades, you and I.
I think the commodification of the athlete and the corporatization of large American sporting events, college and pro, has been the most distressful development. It can be laid back at the feet of television, as a lot of things can be. I think that the most important change in the actual people who play the game, and this goes across almost all sports, is big people who are fast. I remember the first time I ever saw Boris Becker, right after he won Wimbledon for the first time when he was 19 or whatever it was, he looked like a linebacker. LeBron James is the same size as Antonio Gates, who's a tight end. Karl Malone was 6'9" and ran like a deer. Every sport I can think of, the biggest difference, and don't factor PEDs in on this at all, but the fact is we have big people who are really fast.
Is it too much on the fantasy level to look forward and guess what the sports landscape is going to look like 20 years hence?
I think, first of all, let's talk about the fantasy level, because that's a development in the last 10 or 15 years that's just exploded. I think fans have found a way to be vicariously part of the game when they have, when they've been removed from the actual game. One of the ways they've done it is fantasy sports, where you can be your own general manager. This has changed not only sports, but gambling. Down the line, I think the freight train of genetic manipulation is coming down the tracks, and I don't think anybody's ready for it. They're going to have to construct an entirely new ethics around genetic manipulation and considering the hysteria that's attended chemical enhancement of sports, I'm not real optimistic that they're able to handle it.
Charlie, when you were a child and all things, or at least lots of things related to sports, seemed possible, was there a particular sports fantasy you entertained, or maybe you were able to fulfill that dream?
I'm fairly sure I didn't fulfill the dream. I was always intrigued by swimming the English Channel. I thought that was an interesting thing to do. I read a story in Sports Illustrated about it, and I remember one story of a guy hallucinating that the water around him was filled with dogs.
Yikes.
Which I thought was kind of an interesting hallucination. You know, that kind of thing. But in terms of team sports, I mean, I wanted to be a basketball player when I was very young, and I didn't grow into that. So, you know, here we are.
I had wanted to jump off this week's theme for a bit and into some of this week's news, but the following story fits both categories, Charlie. After two hearings in New York that failed to produce a settlement in NFL v. Brady, Judge Richard Berman scheduled another hearing for August the 31st and said he would issue a ruling by September 4th, but it will probably go well beyond that.
Yeah, I think Judge Berman expected at this point in the summer to be in the Hamptons on his third martini, and I think he's fed up with both sides. He seems to be uniquely fed up with the way the NFL has conducted its business, which I find interesting. But again, this is a problem that should have gone away at the end of January. Why it is still in the news and why it is still of this immense national importance, I have no idea. It's a remarkable media story.
The competition at the Rio Olympics next summer will include golf.
No!
The last time golf was an Olympic sport was 1904, and those games also featured the standing high jump, standing broad jump, and standing triple jump. So can we look forward to the return of those compelling events?
I don't know if you know it, Bill, but you have wandered into my wheelhouse. The 1904 Olympic Games in St. Louis are probably my favorite sporting event ever. Not only did they have all the events you mentioned, they had tug of war.
Excellent.
Not only that, these Olympics were put together to coincide with the 1904 World's Fair. So they extended over almost the entire summer. At the World's Fair, they had what they called living exhibits of native tribes from around the world. And there was a day in the Olympics called the Aboriginal People's Games or something, where the various tribes from around the world who were living exhibits came out and competed. The whole thing revolted Pierre de Coubertin so much that he went back to Europe and arranged a new cycle for the Olympics so this wouldn't count. They had the next Summer Olympics in 1906, so people would forget about 1904. This is the Olympics where Fred Lors took a taxi cab in the marathon. Mm-hmm. This was the Olympics where the eventual winner of that marathon almost died because they'd been giving him strychnine to restrict his blood flow for the last 5 miles. This is the Olympics where a Cuban marathon runner took a boat to New Orleans, got his pocket picked, hitchhiked to St. Louis, showed up at the starting line in street shoes and long pants, and an American athlete went and got a pair of scissors and cut off the guy's pants and he ran for the marathon. This is one of the great sporting events of our time. So any vestige of the 1904 Olympics is a spit in the eye to the spirit of Pierre de Coubertin, including golf this time.
I just had no idea that I had opened up this cornucopia of wondrous, wondrous things. You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, and for 22 years, he's been joining me here at Only a Game. Let's see, that's a little over two decades, Charlie.
That's right, two decades. Only one. We only recently became plural.
Okay.
I feel younger already.
In any case, thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Earlier in the program, we heard from former pro athlete Jeremy Bloom, who at the age of 29 was named by Forbes magazine as one of the 30 most influential people in technology. Ambitious fellow. But as Alyssa Eli has found, ambition can strike those of any age.
Everyone was passing us, heading up the mountain. Most were younger, 10 years, 20, 30, willing to chat briefly about weather, but also pointed in their pace. They had distance to cover. We didn't take it personally. We were sitting on a slanting boulder, mostly sliding off, but pretending it was restful, when a small pair of light-up sneakers passed on the left. The little boy was deliberate, sure-footed, not in any way flashy, but also not in any way friendly. He didn't greet us. A young woman followed and nodded to us on behalf of both of them. "How old are you?" my partner asked the boy. 6, his mother said. He'd stopped on a rock and, looking ahead to where the path steepened, stood on one foot while he waited for her. My friend said something admiring about his fleetness. "This is his 5th 4,000-footer," his mom said. She wasn't being boastful. No future college application needed to know about it, but these were the facts. While he balanced, she took a minute and filled us in. They lived on a nearby farm with her husband, where they raised pasture-fed beef and Hunter kept track of the eggs. He sold them out of their kitchen. Business was brisk. Climbing all the New Hampshire 4,000-footers had been his idea. He'd first brought it up when he turned 5. They were keeping a list, as peak baggers do, with dates and weather conditions. Today they were planning to head to the peak above the hut where we were stopping. That was 4,902 feet. If the weather held, they had another mountain planned for tomorrow, 4,698 feet. Hunter was in it for all 48 peaks of that region, and she was his bemused but willing Sherpa. "But why does he want to do this?" my friend said. "Why?" All three of us looked at Hunter. He scratched an ear shyly. He wasn't talking. But his mother knew. There was love and philosophical pride in her voice. "He doesn't think he's high enough," she said.
Alyssa Eli is a psychiatrist in Massachusetts. The week spent exploring how athletes and leagues and fans and the games themselves change over time has had me recalling my own earliest connection to sports. One of the most powerful images of that connection involves a transistor radio I'd gotten for a birthday present when I was perhaps 7. I think it was the only thing for which I'd asked, and I thought it was the most magnificent appliance anybody'd ever invented. It even had an earplug so that nobody would know when I was listening to night games after I was supposed to have been asleep. In one of those games, the San Francisco Giants, late of New York, entered the ninth inning down 10 runs, at least as I remember it. In the ninth, cobbling together an unlikely sequence of base hits, walks, errors, and the occasional home run, they scored 9 times. At some point early in that bonanza of runs, I picked up a bat and began pretending I was each Giant hitter. I swung at strikes and contemptuously let the balls go by. When a left-handed hitter came up, I stepped to the other side of the imaginary plate in my bedroom. I ran out the hits, insofar as the space would allow. I began to believe this ritual was playing a part in the comeback. No, I began to know it. When the Giants came up a run short, I sort of couldn't believe it. I felt I'd been participating in 9 runs worth of brilliance that was maybe magic. And when the game ended, I wasn't sure whether the Giants had let me down or vice versa. I don't know why I remember that game when I swung a bat in my bedroom, hitter after hitter, run after run. Maybe it's because I never did it again.